Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
A very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments you can join us for the next in our weekly reflections on the Sunday Gospel, and then on a walkabout in the very gardens of the papal residence at Castel Gandolfo. Thanks so much for joining me once again. I'm about to respect our weekly rendezvous with Jill Bevilacqua, joining her for this week's edition of a feature by the intriguing title of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, a programme which she writes and presents and where the Sunday Gospel is presented in a very personal manner. One which begins, as always, with Sean Patrick Lovett reading the Gospel for us. For this, the 22nd Sunday in Ordinary Time.
The Pharisees and some of the experts in the law who had come from Jerusalem gathered around Jesus. They had observed a few of his disciples eating meals without having purified, that is to say, washed, their hands. The Pharisees, and in fact all Jews, cling to the custom of their ancestors and never eat without scrupulously washing their hands. Moreover, they never eat anything from the market without first sprinkling it. There are many other traditions they observe. For example, the washing of cups and jugs and kettles. So the Pharisees and the scribes questioned him, "Why do your disciples not follow the tradition of our ancestors, but instead take food without purifying their hands?" He said to them, "How accurately Isaiah prophesied about you hypocrites when he wrote, 'This people pays me lip service, but their heart is far from me. Empty is the reverence they do me, because they teach as dogmas mere human precepts.' You disregard God's commandment and cling to what is human tradition." He summoned the crowd again and said to them, "Hear me, all of you, and try to understand. Nothing that enters a man from outside can make him impure. That which comes out of him, and only that, constitutes impurity. Let everyone heed what he hears. Wicked designs come from the deep recesses of the heart. Acts of fornication, theft, murder, adulterous conduct, greed, maliciousness, deceit, sensuality, envy, blasphemy, arrogance, an obtuse spirit. All these evils come from within, and render a man impure."
After the parenthesis of the last few weeks, when John's Gospel brought us our Lord's great discourse on the bread of life, we return today to the Gospel of Mark, and a celebrated occasion when Jesus made an important distinction between outward behaviour and inward attitudes. The Pharisees have come from Jerusalem with some of the scribes, the experts in the law, as we heard. Jesus had been in Jerusalem recently, probably for the feast of Passover, and now he was back in Galilee, probably in Capernaum, which was his base. And these men had followed him, not because they wanted to become disciples, but in order to watch him and his followers, in the hope of catching him out in what he taught or did. They're not long in finding something to criticize.
Thank you.
Why do your disciples not follow the tradition of our ancestors, but instead take food without purifying their hands?
What might to us seem merely a reference to a lack of hygiene was a far more serious accusation of disrespect for an age-old custom, a disregard for that ritual cleanliness which had become an essential part of Jewish life and to which the Pharisees paid an exaggerated honour. Mark, who was writing for non-Jews, the Romans in particular, goes into some detail in his explanation. "They cling to the custom of their ancestors," we heard, "and never eat without scrupulously washing their hands." "Washing their arms as far as the elbow," runs another version. Next comes the market. Now, not to eat anything from the market without first sprinkling it sounds reasonable enough. We all wash fruit, salad and other vegetables, though we might look askance at someone who insisted on doing the same to dry foods. But in other versions, the picture's a little different. "On returning from the marketplace, they never eat without first sprinkling themselves," we read in the Jerusalem Bible. And the Revised Standard Version has, "When they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they purify themselves." The Vulgate has simply, "When they come from the market, unless they be washed, they eat not." The particular complaint the Pharisees make has to do with eating, with food. But if we look at the definition of the Pharisee, separated or set apart, it's hardly surprising that they would feel contaminated every time they went to the market. As one scholar comments, they thought that the market might pollute them. As for the washing of cups and pots and bronze dishes, there was apparently a whole chapter of the Talmud dedicated to that. There were phrases like these: "If someone eats bread," and this of course could mean any food, "without washing his hands, it's as if he were going with a prostitute." And again, "He who despises the washing of hands will be removed from this world." Ominous. And supposing there was no water in the immediate vicinity, what then? One must go and look for it, travelling anything up to 4 miles. So the Pharisee teachers prescribed. Knowing all this as he did, Jesus wastes no time in defending the conduct of his disciples, but goes straight to the heart of the matter. "Well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites," and he quotes the prophet's complaint. Speaking in the name of God, Isaiah had declared,
"This people honours me only with lip service, while their hearts are far from me. The worship they offer me is worthless. The doctrines they teach are only human regulations."
And Jesus concluded,
"You put aside the commandment of God to cling to human traditions."
In Matthew's account of the same episode, he quotes the disciples as saying to Jesus in private, "Do you know that the Pharisees were shocked when they heard what you said?" But our Lord, who naturally knew very well how the Pharisees felt, told his disciples,
"Leave them alone. They are blind men leading blind men. And if one blind man leads another, both will fall into a pit."
It could easily be concluded from this exchange with the Pharisees that Jesus had no respect for tradition or commonly accepted codes of behaviour. But we find him in the Gospels reminding a Pharisee who had invited him to dinner that he had neglected to perform what was a common gesture of courtesy to a guest. A scholar reminds us,
"An important Hebrew custom was the washing of the guest's feet, a gesture of welcome in a hot, dusty country where stony roads often made foot travel a painful experience."
Back in the Old Testament, in fact, there was the famous occasion when Abraham was sitting at the door of his tent in the heat of the day, when, behold, 3 men stood in front of him. And what does he do? He offers them water to drink and to wash the dust from their feet. And the visitors, as we know, turned out to be angels. When Jesus was at table in the house of Simon the Pharisee, a woman known as a sinner came in with an alabaster flask of ointment, and recounts Luke,
"Standing behind him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head and kissed his feet and anointed them with the ointment."
And Jesus reproaches Simon, who is more concerned to judge his guest for letting himself be touched by a public sinner.
"Do you see this woman? I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she has wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but from the time I came in, she has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with ointment.
Apart from the customs of washing after contact with the unclean or before touching food, there was also the opposite, as recounted by Sir James Fraser, the Scottish anthropologist, in The Golden Bough.
It is a common belief that the effect of contact with a sacred object must be removed, by washing or otherwise, before a man is free to mingle with his fellows. Thus the Jews wash their hands after reading the sacred scriptures. Before coming forth from the tabernacle after the sin offering, the high priest had to wash himself and put off the garments which he had worn in the holy place.
Certainly, the whole idea of using water to purify the person, whether in the ordinary act of washing to cleanse the body of dirt or in a symbolic act of spiritual purification, runs through all cultures and all religions. Nor has literature resisted the temptation to use such an act to dramatic effect, as in the sleepwalking scene of Shakespeare's Macbeth, when the guilty queen tries in vain to wash the blood from the hand that has committed murder. A waiting woman takes a doctor to observe Lady Macbeth sleepwalking. And the doctor observes how she rubs her hands. The woman answers, it's an accustomed action with her to seem thus washing her hands. I've known her to continue in this for a quarter of an hour.
Yet here's a spot. Out, damned spot, out, I say. Yet who would have thought the old man to have had so much blood in him? What? Will these hands never be clean? Here's the smell of the blood still. All the perfumes of Arabia will not sweeten this little hand. Oh!
Far removed from the imagination of the dramatist, in the real-life drama of the Passion, there's another scene of ritual hand-washing.
So when Pilate saw that he was gaining nothing, but rather that a riot was beginning, he took water and washed his hands before the crowd, saying, I am innocent of this righteous man's blood. See to it yourselves.
Writes a scholar.
Pilate abjures his responsibility with a typically oriental symbolic gesture. In reality, his blame is not entirely taken away thus.
Probably no symbolic act of hand-washing is more celebrated than this. There are, of course, genuine acts of this kind, one of which still exists in the church's liturgy. It takes place at the offertory and is one of the quieter, though no less significant, moments of the Mass. After he has offered the water and wine, the priest goes to the side of the altar and washes his hands, saying to himself, Lord, wash away my iniquity, cleanse me from my sin. The ceremony originated, we're told, in the practical necessity of cleansing the fingers after handling loaves of bread, but came to signify that purity with which the sacred mysteries should be approached. When there's a server, he pours the water over the celebrant's fingers and catches it in a bowl. Until the Second Vatican Council, the priest recited part of a psalm while washing the extremities of his fingers. Known as the lavabo, from the first words he spoke, the ceremony was explained, runs a note in the old Roman Missal, by the mystical reason that one can never be pure enough to touch the God of all purity. The psalm is described as the prayer of a man of integrity, or prayer of the blameless.
I will wash my hands among the innocent, and will compass thine altar, O Lord, that I may hear the voice of praise, and tell of all thy wondrous works. I have loved, O Lord, the beauty of thy house, and the place where dwelleth thy glory. Take not away my soul, O God, with the wicked, nor my life with men of blood, in whose hands are iniquities, their right hand is filled with gifts. But I have walked in my innocence. Redeem me, and have mercy on me. My foot hath stood in the direct way, in the churches. I will bless thee, O Lord.
In a comment on the psalm, a scholar writes,
the text joins this declaration of innocence to an entrance liturgy to the temple, reminding us that the prayer is said by the priest before the great prayer of the Eucharistic canon.
Modern translations make this clear, as in this one.
To prove my innocence, I wash my hands and take my place around your altar.
Or in this,
I wash my hands in innocence and join the procession round your altar.
When our Lord accused the Pharisees of lip service, did he have this psalm in mind? The verse preceding that which opens the lavabo is revealing.
I never take my place with liars, and with hypocrites I shall not go. I hate the evildoers' company. I will not take my place with the wicked.
I refuse to sit down with the wicked, runs another version. It does smack strangely of the Pharisees' attitude and their disapproval of Jesus for sitting down with sinners. In the last part of today's Gospel, Jesus calls the crowd to him and urges them to try to understand that only what comes out of a man can make him impure. But how much the crowd understood is doubtful, as even his followers questioned him, writes Mark, when he had gone back into the house, away from the crowd. Perhaps today we think we have understood, but can we claim honestly to be better than the Pharisees? As a modern scholar comments,
the same faults could be urged against ourselves. Catholics from the highest to the lowest have been guilty of them. St. John Chrysostom was not the first or the last to say, "We imitate the hypocrites, we have even surpassed them."
Perhaps we would do well to remember what St. Paul wrote to the Corinthians. Let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall.
My thanks there go to Jill Bevilacqua for yet another moving reflection on the Sunday Gospel, a programme by the title of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. My thanks too go to Sean Patrick Lovett, whose voice you heard throughout the programme. Meanwhile, a change of plans this week. We won't be joining Joan Lewis as she's currently away in the United States. And so her weekly review of all things Vatican will be postponed to next week. But given the heat, I thought you might enjoy instead a virtual breath of fresh air up in the Alban Hills. That's with a former colleague of mine here at the radio, Arthur Baum, who will take us by the hand and for a walk in the gardens of the papal summer residence at Castel Gandolfo. Gardens with a stunning layout and indeed three villas on the grounds, one of which was built over a not-so-friendly Roman emperor's villa. It's a place which even has a farm and where the gardens are definitely not open to the public, unlike those in Vatican City, which you can visit on a guided tour if you wish to book this ahead of time. But let's listen to Arthur Baum taking us round the gardens at Castel Gandolfo.
People already know that there is the papal palace there, the summer residence of the Pope, where he also gives the Angelus on Sundays. Anyone who's in Rome can go out there on a Sunday and see the Pope and receive his blessing at the Angelus. What they don't see, of course, is the papal villa and the gardens and the park that attaches to Castel Gandolfo. I don't know how well people are informed on where it is. It's about 20 miles out of Rome, up in the Alban Hills, a beautiful situation where it gets the sea breeze. The sea is about 30 kilometres away, but on a clear weather you can see ships even on the sea.
It's the area the Italians call Castelli Romani.
The Castelli Romani, yes, are very well known for their fresh air. When you come from the stifling heat of Rome in the summer up to this wonderfully fresh air of the Castelli Romani, it's quite a difference. It is, of course, warm there too. Only
yes, but it faces north, I believe, doesn't it?
It faces north, and above all, it is higher up. So there's always some sort of a breeze there, and you get this lovely breeze. The sea is about 30 kilometres away, but there's no land between the Castelli Romani and the sea, so the castelli, in particular Castel Gandolfo, gets all this fresh sea air.
So the Pope is a lucky man.
He's a lucky man when he can get out there. I think everyone's glad that he has this chance to escape from the... those of us who live here know what it is in Rome in the summer, that he can at least escape for a couple of months and do his work out there in more pleasant circumstances. Not actually alongside the papal residence. There's another part of Castel Gandolfo, which is only a small place. They surround what is called the Villa Barberini. That's this famous family in Rome in the 17th century, the Barberini family. And they built this villa with the surrounding gardens. Incidentally, the whole of the Vatican territory out there is about one quarter as big again as the Vatican City in Rome. The Vatican City, the official city, is 110 acres here in the centre of Rome. Out there in Castel Gandolfo, it's about 140 acres. So you can see there's much more ground. It comprises three villas, not very large, but there are three villas, and the surrounding gardens and parks, and a farm. There's even a farm which takes in about half the territory out there, provides things like milk and eggs and olive oil. Which
you
is
used to be able to buy milk in the Vatican.
In the Vatican, yes, shop. In the shop. And you could buy olive oil, because there are olive trees out there on this papal farm, and the oil was sold in the Vatican shop. The gardens were originally laid out in the 17th century in that typical Italian style. You know, it reminds us of the Elizabethan style, because in Elizabethan England there was this imitation of Italian gardening, terribly formal, all gravel paths.
With hedges.
With hedges alongside them, strict geometrical patterns. And here in Rome and out in Castel Gandolfo, they use the Boboli Gardens in Florence as a model. Typically Italian gardens, which is rather formal to us today. The ones you see today are rather nicer, because they were rearranged in the 1930s at the wish of Pope Pius XI. And the architect at the time, the garden architect, added a lot of flower beds, so that alongside this dark green of the hedges and the trees, you get wonderful splashes of colour. Very, very large flower beds with their geraniums and begonias and things like that. So it was really a very colourful position. The Villa Barberini in the middle of these gardens is itself built on the foundations of an ancient Roman villa. It was a summer palace of the Emperor Domitian, which was built out there. And in these 1930 rearrangements, they incorporated some of the ancient remains into the present gardens. There's a wonderful arcade and a semi-buried arcade belonging to this ancient villa. It used to support the main buildings of the Emperor Domitian's palace, now supports some of the terraces of the gardens. Very interesting also, there's a large cross there, about 2 metres high, which was put up by Pope Pius XI in order to show the victory of Christianity over paganism. After all, the Emperor Domitian, who originally built this palace, was well known for his persecution of the Christians. There were terrible persecutions in his reign in the first century. So it's, if you like, I suppose we could call it the irony of history, that now on his villa there is a papal villa, and there is this enormous cross. There's also a theatre, incidentally, the remains of a theatre which he built there for his guests. Has had room at least for about 400. So you can imagine the ancient Romans there in their summer villa, which today is part of these papal grounds. The grounds themselves, as I say, they're not open to the public. Tourist groups have no chance whatsoever. It's no use asking. You can look around them if you can prove genuine motive, if you're concerned in historical or archaeological research or something, or artistic research, then you can get a permit. And journalists can occasionally get a permit. They have to go through the usual channels in the Vatican of journalists wishing to see Vatican territory and buildings. And all in all, there are about 4,000 to 5,000 people a year who are able to see round these gardens at Castel Gandolfo. The Villa Barberini, in the various excavations and rebuildings, they've unearthed a lot of treasures of antiquity, Roman and even Greek art treasures from the past, and they've now been installed in a museum in this Villa Barberini, which again is not open to the public. A walk around the gardens is marvellous because even in all this heat of the summer, apart from the breeze, they're so shady. You see, they're full of cypresses, oaks, yew trees, and these wonderful Mediterranean pines, you know, these big umbrella pines which cover everything. So to stroll around there, it really is a pleasure. The temperature, of course, is always slightly lower than in Rome, and there's this fresh breeze. It's almost like, I suppose you could call it a Vatican national park, in a sense, because it's wonderful for the bird life. In the Vatican territory, no hunting is allowed of any sort, so that rare birds come and build their nests there. It's a delight for the ornithologists. There are squirrels. There are even foxes to be found in these gardens, and wild strawberries growing. A really pleasant sort of national park. And, of course, there's no problem with the water. There are 15 gardeners to keep everything in order, and a lot of their work in the summer is with sprinkling, with water. I imagine they have no problem in finding it, because there is plenty of it in the Alban Hills. The Papal Gardens, Castel Gandolfo, is on one side of this volcanic crater overlooking Lake Alban. On the other side in the forest is the English College. The English College in the heart of Rome actually has its summer house, an old house out there. And I know that in the grounds there of the English College, they've got about 13 springs of natural mineral water. So there's no shortage of water for swimming pools or anything you like to build. And this is useful also for the papal gardens there in Castel Gandolfo. One time, by the way, they were very much open to the public, or to refugees, as they were in those days, during the Second World War. At the end of the war, when the Allies were advancing and the Germans were trying to defend their position in Rome, thousands and thousands of Italian refugees entered these grounds of the Vatican, and the Vatican obviously opened them up. They said there's no question of keeping people out if they're in need like this. And the papal villas were made into hospitals, and people were accommodated there, and the gardens were used by them.
Thanks there go to former colleague Arthur Baum for this virtual tour of the gardens of the Papal Villa at Castel Gandolfo. And unfortunately, that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. I'd like to remind you that we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org.
Laudator Jesus Christus.